Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. I'm your host, Holly, and today I'm back with another episode for you guys. First off, I just want to apologize for not having an episode out last week. You guys know the saying, when it rains, it pours, and let me just say, it was pouring at my house last week. First, my son was super sick. He was down and out. Then our 1993 Jeep Wrangler went down on us. And then it was all followed by my washing machine going out, my Samsung washing machine. We've had the thing for like 13 years. It finally gave out. Thankfully, I will say, I am very blessed with a husband who is extremely mechanically inclined. He was able to get the Jeep running again. We were able to get the wash machine completely tore apart. We have a front loader, which that was a whole task in and of itself. And $154 later, we restored the washing machine, good as new. So I didn't have to spend thousands of dollars on a new set because I have to have a matching set, you know? So anyways, I just want to say I'm so sorry. Thank you guys for understanding. And I am back today. So let's get to it. As you can probably tell from the title of today's episode, this is an unsolved case. And I know that not everyone enjoys listening to unsolved cases because there's no clear resolution, no definitive ending, no answers, and that can be extremely frustrating. But I truly believe these cases are some of the most important cases to continue telling. Much like the Missing Mondays cases that I cover, I believe there are people out there who know something. Someone has a detail, a memory, or a piece of information that could help move these cases forward. It is always my hope, my dream, that these stories reach the right ears and that someone realizes that information they've been holding on to matters. I know that for many people, true crime is consumed as entertainment or as a way to better understand the darkness that exists in this world. But for me, there is a deeper purpose behind what I do with this platform. Awareness is everything. The more attention these cases receive, the better the chances that answers will eventually come. And while I understand that some listeners prefer cases where justice has already been served, it's important to remember that this is real life for these families. These are real people living every day without answers, holding out hope that one day they will finally have justice. And you truly never know. By telling these stories, by keeping these names alive, it might be what brings those families one step closer to answers that they deserve. For this case specifically, there isn't a lot of coverage out there. It was actually suggested to me by a listener, and it was one I wasn't familiar with before researching it for myself. I think one of the main reasons this case hasn't been widely covered by other true crime creators is because the available information is pretty sparse. There aren't a lot of clear answers, timelines, or definitive conclusions, and that can make these cases harder to tell. But if you've been following me for any length of time, you know how strongly I feel about still sharing these stories. These people matter. They are not just a name in a case file. They are loved. They are missed every single day, and they deserve to be remembered. Their names deserve to be spoken. Before we get into all of the details for today's case, I do have a Patreon shout out to give. This week, I had Rachel join the Patreon family. Thank you so much, Rachel, for supporting me, my mission, and passion for the podcast. I have to say that every time I get that notification that someone new joined, it blows me away. This little random spur of the moment podcast has turned into so much more, and knowing that I have a community of supporters backing me is what fuels my fire to continue. So a major thank you. If y'all want to be like my girl Rachel and join the Patreon family, you can join for just $2 a month. Not only will you be supporting me and my dream, but you will also be dropping those annoying and pesky ads. If you want to join, you can head over to www.patreon.com/crimewithholly to sign up. All right, guys, I know I've been blabbing way longer than what I normally do, so without further ado, let's get into the unsolved case of Kevin Ives and Dawn Henry. Donald George Henry was born on September 30th, 1970 to his parents Curtis Henry and Marvel Epperson. Larry Kevin Ives, who went by his middle name of Kevin, was born just a few months earlier on April 28th, 1970 to his parents Larry and Linda Ives. Both Don and Kevin grew up in Alexander, Arkansas. Some articles do state that the boys grew up in Bryant, but when you look at the distance between the two towns, it's only a few minutes apart. They're like neighboring towns. From what I've been able to confirm, Alexander is where they primarily hung out and grew up. Alexander is a very small town that sits within Pulaski and Saline counties. According to the 2020 census, the population was just under 3,400 people. But if you look back in the early 1990s, the population was closer to just over 300 people. So when I say at that time it was a small town, I really mean small. The town itself was originally founded as a construction camp for a nearby railroad. Kevin and Don were the best of friends. They attended the same high school and were often seen together, regularly spending time with one another. There isn't a lot of detailed information available about their early childhoods, but what is known is that both boys were very well liked by their peers and were considered popular at school. At the time of their murders, the boys were waiting for the school year to begin, where they would be returning as seniors at Bryant High School. Don was just 16 years old and Kevin was 17. Once again, there isn't a lot of information available about who they were as individuals, but from the photos I've seen, they look like typical teenage boys. Happy, they were carefree, with those easy-go-lucky smiles that feel frozen in time. What has been reported is that both Don and Kevin loved working on their cars. One of them owned a Firebird and the other drove a Camaro. They also enjoyed hunting and spending time with their girlfriends, just, again, living normal teenage lives. On the night of August 22nd, 1987, Don and Kevin met up with a group of friends at a local commuter parking lot. At the time, this parking lot was known as a popular hangout spot for local teens to meet up and hang out. Sometime around midnight, the two decided to head back to Don's house where they planned to spend the night. At some point, they had made the decision on the way to Don's house that they wanted to actually go night hunting. When they got to his house, Don went inside to talk with his dad while Kevin waited out on the porch. After chatting for a bit, Don grabbed a .22 caliber rifle along with one of his dad's spotlights. At approximately 12:15 a.m., now officially August 23rd, 1987, Don and Kevin headed out. They didn't have far to go. Just outside of Don's home was a heavily wooded area, and behind it ran a set of railroad tracks. After that moment, after they walked away from his house, what happened next is unknown. It's assumed that they went out and began their hunting trip, but there's no way to know for sure. It's unclear whether they crossed paths with anyone or if they may have planned to meet up with someone else while they were out there. But what happened next was something that no one could have anticipated. Around 4 a.m. on August 23rd, 1987, in Alexander, Arkansas, a 6,000-ton cargo train, reported to be nearly a mile long, was making its routine overnight run toward Little Rock. The train was traveling at approximately 52 miles per hour with engineer Stephen Schroyer at the controls. As the train moved down the tracks, Stephen noticed something ahead in the distance lying across the rails. As they got closer, he quickly realized what he was seeing. Two individuals were lying parallel across the train tracks. Both boys were positioned in the exact same way. They were lying side by side, their arms straight down at their sides, and they appeared to be covered from the waist down with a light green tarp. Stephen immediately began blaring the train's horn and initiated an emergency stop. But a 6,000-ton train does not stop quickly. Despite his efforts to warn the boys and slow the train, it struck them and carried their bodies nearly half a mile before finally coming to a complete stop. Stephen and the rest of the train crew immediately called 911. When authorities and EMTs arrived on scene, they found Don's .22 caliber rifle lying next to him on the tracks. According to an article published on Medium.com, EMTs at the scene noted several things that immediately raised concerns. They observed that the boys' blood appeared darker than it should have been, as though it had lacked oxygen. One EMT also stated that the blood was oozing rather than fresh, and that the boys' skin appeared pale and colorless, indications that Kevin and Don may have been deceased for some time before they were placed on the tracks. Another critical detail came from engineer Stephen Schroyer himself. He told authorities exactly what he had seen before the train struck them, specifically describing how the boys were lying and recalling the light green tarp covering them from the waist down. But here's where things get strange. When authorities arrived on scene, that green tarp was nowhere to be found. And according to reports, it was never located. We'll come back to that tarp later, but for now, keep that little tidbit in the back of your mind. So despite the severe condition of their bodies, due to being struck by this huge, massive train, authorities were able to identify the victims as Kevin Ives and Don Henry. Their bodies were sent for autopsies, which were performed by the state medical examiner, Dr. Fahmy Malik. Dr. Malik concluded that the boys had smoked the equivalent of up to 20 marijuana cigarettes, or 20 joints, which he claimed caused them to become so intoxicated that they laid down on the tracks, they passed out, and entered what he described as a marijuana-induced coma. According to Dr. Malik, they were so deeply impaired that they could not feel or hear the train approaching. Their deaths were officially ruled accidental, caused by marijuana intoxication. When the boys' families heard this conclusion, and frankly much of the surrounding community, no one believed it. The only people who seemed to accept this explanation were Dr. Malik himself and law enforcement. Kevin and Don's parents were adamant that this simply was not who their sons were. They insisted that the boys didn't smoke, they didn't do drugs, and they actively avoided illegal activity. They described the kids as good kids. Now, of course, kids can and do hide things from their parents, but there were other details that made this explanation even harder to accept. One of the biggest red flags for the families was the fact that both boys were found lying in the exact same position. If this truly had been a drug-induced coma, it's difficult to understand how the boys could have been positioned so perfectly across the tracks, lying side by side, aligned in the exact same way, just as the train engineer later described. It doesn't make sense. Another major point people couldn't get past was the idea being pushed by both the medical examiner and law enforcement that the boys had somehow slept through the train's horn. I don't know about you, but anyone who has ever been anywhere near a passing train know that that's just not something you hear. Yes, you hear the horn, of course, but you also hear the wheels grinding against the tracks. You hear the machinery. You hear all of its components working together to power this massive machine forward. And you don't just hear it. You feel it. You feel the train's movement when you are that close. This was a huge, multi-ton mass of steel and metal that is just barreling down the tracks at over 50 miles per hour. The ground would have been rumbling. It would have been shaking. The air would have been vibrating. The idea that two teenage boys could have been lying there completely unaware, passed out through all of that, was simply unfathomable to most people who learned about this case. Don's father, Curtis Henry, never believed for a second that this was how his son died. One of the biggest reasons was Don's rifle. Curtis said Don was extremely particular about his firearm. He took pride in it. He handled it carefully and treated it with respect. Don would have never have just laid it down in the gravel or laid it down on the train tracks, especially not willy-nilly, for fear of scratching it or damaging it. To Curtis, the idea that Don would place his rifle on the tracks next to him just did not make sense. He knew his son, and he knew his son wouldn't have done that. After talking with one another, both families went to authorities and asked them to please take another look at the case. In their gut, something was wrong. The pieces weren't fitting together, and they believed deep down that what they were being told simply wasn't the truth. But to law enforcement, the case was closed. The medical examiner had ruled the deaths accidental, and his conclusion was treated as final. There was no desire to dig deeper, no interest in re-examining the evidence. To them, two teenage boys had simply died in a tragic accident on the train tracks one summer night after smoking some marijuana. With authorities refusing to take another look, Kevin and Don's parents made the difficult decision to hire their own private investigator. One of the first things the investigator did was approach law enforcement and formally request that the case be reopened. He was met with the same resistance the family had already faced. With no help coming from authorities, the private investigator and the boys' parents turned to the media and held a press conference. Their goal was to bring renewed attention to the case in hopes that someone might come forward with information and to apply public pressure on law enforcement to reconsider their stance. And thankfully, this time it worked. The authorities agreed to reopen the case and re-examine the evidence. Once the case was reopened, a prosecutor named Richard Garrett became involved. One of his first major decisions was to have both boys' bodies exhumed so a second autopsy could be performed by a different medical examiner. When that second autopsy was completed, the findings were drastically different from the first. This new examiner determined that Kevin and Don had not smoked anywhere near 20 marijuana joints. Instead, the estimate was closer to 1 to 3 joints. The doctor also stated that the boys would have needed more than 4,000 times the amount of THC actually found in their systems in order to be in any kind of drug-induced coma described by Dr. Malik. Several medical professionals also reviewed the original findings and described them as highly unusual. Some even stating that they had never heard of anyone becoming unconscious solely from exposure from THC, regardless of the amount. This second medical examiner also concluded that there was sufficient evidence to suggest that at least one of the boys was already dead before being placed on the tracks, and that the other was likely unconscious. With these findings, the manner of death was changed from accidental to probable homicide. Prosecutor Richard Garrett was determined to find out what had really happened to these boys. One detail in particular stood out to him. The light green tarp the train engineer had reported seeing on the boys' bodies before the collision. Stephen Schroyer, the engineer, remained adamant that the tarp was there. But when authorities arrived on scene, it was nowhere to be found. Stephen later stated that he told law enforcement about the tarp that very night. But because it wasn't immediately located near the scene, his account was brushed aside. There were even questions about whether the tarp existed at all. But Stephen swore up and down that the tarp was there and he knows what he saw. And it's important to remember that after striking the boys, the train continued traveling nearly half a mile. If that tarp was dislodged, it could have been anywhere along that stretch of track. It seems from what I've read and learned about this case, it appears that because the case was initially ruled an accident, little effort was made to search for or recover the tarp. It was dismissed as either irrelevant or imaginary. In 1988, Stephen made a statement addressing the skepticism surrounding the tarp. He said, quote, "That to me would be like questioning the existence of the boys on the track, because what's real is real and what's not is not, and it was there as well as the boys," end quote. Stephen was clearly frustrated that no real attention had ever been given to this detail. And while a tarp might seem insignificant, there's no way of knowing what kind of evidence it could have held. And I feel like because this was ruled an accident, that this tarp was never properly looked for. And it's unfortunate because it might have been the piece missing from this puzzle. So after the second autopsy, a third and final autopsy was conducted. And this time, even more disturbing details emerged. This medical examiner found evidence suggesting that Don had suffered stab wounds to his back and that Kevin had sustained a severe blow to his head. The third autopsy also determined that the blow Kevin suffered to his head did not come from the train. The medical examiner examined a shirt belonging to Don, and that shirt showed damage to the back that matched the wounds found on his body. What makes this detail especially confusing, though, is that reports state that Don was not wearing a shirt at the time that he and Kevin were struck by the train. So somehow this shirt was within the area and not on his body at the time of the train's impact. It's unclear exactly where the shirt was found, whether it was lying nearby, next to the boys, or somewhere else entirely, but the fact that it wasn't on him at the time of impact raises serious questions. As for Kevin, the blow he sustained was to the left side of his head, and the injury pattern was consistent with being struck by an object similar in shape to the butt of Don's rifle. Based on this, investigators believe the rifle was used as a weapon against Kevin. With these findings, the third autopsy officially changed the manner of death from probable homicide to homicide. At this point, there was no longer any question. Kevin Ives and Don Henry had been murdered. With that determination, investigators finally began the difficult task of trying to piece together what happened to the boys that night. As information was released to the media, tips and leads began to come in. One of those leads involved a disturbing incident that had occurred just a week before the murders. A man wearing military fatigues had been spotted near the railroad tracks acting suspiciously. Police were called to check on him, but when officers attempted to question him, the man opened fire and fled the area. Thankfully, no officers were injured, but the man was never located. Even more concerning, witnesses later reported seeing a man in military fatigues on the night of August 22nd into the early morning hours of August 23rd, less than 200 yards from where Kevin and Don would later be found. Once again, this individual was never identified. But it does make me wonder, though, considering the unexplained green tarp. Maybe this person in military fatigues was out in the woods carrying survival gear, including this tarp, and attacked the boys. We already know this individual was willing to shoot at police. It's not a stretch to believe he could have been capable of harming two teenage boys. But this wasn't the only theory investigators had to consider. As rumors began to circulate, as they often do in small towns, another possibility emerged. Some believed the case was connected to drug trafficking. The theory suggested that Kevin and Don were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that they may have stumbled upon a drug exchange taking place in the woods. According to this idea, the boys were killed to ensure their silence. Prosecutor Richard Garrett leaned toward this theory. He believed the boys had seen something they weren't supposed to see, and that drugs played a role in their deaths. What's truly unfortunate, and likely a major reason this case remains unsolved to this day, is what happened, or rather what didn't happen, at the very beginning. The initial investigation was minimal at best. Evidence wasn't preserved, leads weren't fully followed, and by the time authorities began taking this case seriously, crucial time and possibly crucial evidence had already been lost. From the very beginning, this case was written off as an accident. And because it was classified that way, law enforcement never followed the proper protocols that would normally apply to a homicide investigation. At the time, the county sheriff was a man named James Steed. Kevin and Don's parents were very vocal about the dissatisfaction with how he handled the case, and for good reason. Sheriff Steed severely limited the resources devoted to this investigation. He didn't believe that there was anything more to look into and felt that spending money on the case would be a waste. Even after the deaths were officially ruled homicides and theories involving possible drug trafficking emerged, he continued to refuse funding for further investigation. There were also serious concerns about dishonesty. Sheriff Steed claimed that he had sent the boys' clothing to the FBI for further examination. In reality, he never did. Instead, the clothing was sent to the Arkansas State Crime Lab. He also failed to follow through on investigative steps he had promised, such as testing Don's rifle to determine whether it had been fired that night. This was especially troubling given that nearby residents had reported hearing gunshots shortly before the train passed through. After his lack of drive and motivation on this case, it wasn't a surprise to those in the community when he wasn't reelected as sheriff. After losing his position, he was finally removed from the case. I'll say this carefully, but his handling of the investigation raised serious questions. To many, it felt less like incompetence and more like someone actively avoiding digging deeper. After Sheriff Steed was removed, a series of strange and deeply unsettling deaths occurred. Deaths that many believe may be connected to Kevin and Don's case.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
In November of 1988, a man named Keith McCaskill was murdered. Keith was reportedly an informant for another prosecutor named Dan Harmon, someone who had also been working with Kevin and Don's families early in the investigation. Keith McCaskill was found brutally stabbed 113 times inside of his home. His body had been wrapped in a shower curtain and left in the carport. In the days leading up to his death, Keith reportedly told others that he believed that he had been talking to the wrong people. He was convinced that he was being followed, possibly by police, and feared his life was in danger. He was so certain that something was going to happen to him that he said his goodbyes to family, and he even made funeral arrangements. Keith's connection to Kevin and Don's case was that he had been asked to take aerial photographs of the crime scene, and not long after completing that task, he was dead. Then on January 22, 1989, another man named Greg Collins was found dead in the woods in Prescott, Arkansas. According to reports, Greg had been subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury in relation to Kevin and Don's deaths. He was found with 3 gunshot wounds, 2 to the chest and 1 to the face. Once again, the same medical examiner, Dr. Malik, who conducted the original autopsy on Kevin and Don, ruled Greg's death a suicide. I'll be honest, that conclusion is extremely difficult to accept, and I'm sure you guys feel the same. And then there was the death of another young man named Keith Cooney. Keith Cooney was an acquaintance of both Don and Kevin, and he died just 6 months after they did in what was officially ruled a motorcycle accident. Keith crashed his motorcycle into the back of a semi-truck, and authorities quickly labeled it an accident. But witnesses to the crash told a very different story. They said Keith appeared to be fleeing from another vehicle, being chased, and that he swerved while trying to get away, ultimately hitting the back of the semi. Also, people who claimed to have seen his body after the accident said that his throat had been slashed and injuries to his body weren't consistent with a motorcycle crash either. Now, what is interesting about Keith's death, which makes it all the more suspicious to me, is the fact that Keith had told his mother that he knew something about Don and Kevin's deaths, but he wouldn't say what. However, it was reported that he did confide in his father and a few close friends. According to them, Keith said that he was with Don and Kevin the night that they were killed. He claimed that they were approached by a police car with 2 different officers inside. When that happened, Keith jumped on his motorcycle and took off. Keith believed that Don and Kevin were killed by those officers. And just before Keith's death, he had also been subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury. The next death, that is interesting, that seems like it could potentially be connected, was in April of 1989. A young man named Jeff Rhodes, who was said to be involved in drug trafficking, was murdered. Jeff had told his mother that he had feared for his life, and he also called his father, who lived in Texas, and told him that he needed to leave Arkansas immediately. Jeff told his dad that he knew too much about the boys found on the tracks and about the murder of Keith McCaskill. The very next day, Jeff's motorcycle was found on the side of the road. It hadn't crashed. It wasn't damaged. It was parked neatly with the kickstand down, as if he had stopped voluntarily. But Jeff was gone. A week later, his body was found in a dumpster in Benton, Arkansas. He had been shot in the head. His body was mutilated and then set on fire. After news of Jeff's murder broke, an anonymous caller contacted authorities and said she believed Jeff may have stopped for police shortly before he disappeared. In July of 1989, Richard Winters was found dead from a gunshot wound to the face. He had previously been considered a suspect in Don and Kevin's murders, but had recently agreed to cooperate with the grand jury. That same year, James Millam was found dead inside his home, decapitated with his head completely missing from the scene. And once again, Dr. Malik, the same medical examiner involved in multiple questionable rulings, declared James Millam's death to be from natural causes. He claimed Millam's small dog had eaten his owner's head. Later, when the head was found blocks away, Dr. Malik stated that the dog must have regurgitated it, which is just utterly freaking stupid. There is just no damn way, and it makes me so mad that this was even considered a possibility. I am, however, happy to report, finally, that Dr. Malik resigned from his position in 1991, and there is a whole lot of sketchy information out there about this man. I think he was crooked, and again, lots of information out there, so if you guys want to just go ahead and look into him yourself, I highly suggest it because I think some of the information will blow your mind. It was also reported that James Millam had been a witness to a drug operation and may have witnessed the murders of Kevin and Dawn. In 1990, another man named Jordan Kettleson, who was rumored to have information about the boys' deaths, was found dead in the front seat of his pickup truck with a gunshot wound to the head. And surprise, surprise, there was no police investigation done for his case either. That is a whole slew of murders and deaths that all circle back around to having some sort of weird connection to Kevin Ives and Dawn Henry. What stands out the most across all of these cases is the repeated suggestion of possible police involvement. One witness who went by the name Jerry came forward with information about the night the boys were killed. He said he was in a convenience store parking lot when he saw three boys there, all smoking a joint. Two police officers pulled up, one of the boys jumped on a motorcycle and took off. Jerry said the officers then beat the two boys who remained, threw them in the back of the patrol car, and drove away. After Jerry came forward with this information, he was arrested for unpaid child support and jailed for 90 days. When he was released, he was allegedly told he should leave town, which he did. Another witness later came forward and claimed to have seen two officers beating two individuals outside that same convenience store before driving off. There were also allegations that prosecutor Dan Harmon himself was involved in drug trafficking. I won't go deep into that here, but there is a documented record of serious legal trouble he faced later, including drug-related offenses. This case is filled with rumors, speculation, and conflicting accounts, and it's difficult, if not impossible, to determine what is truly connected and what isn't, and what is fact and what is fiction. But I do want to walk through the major theories because I know many of you listening will form your own opinions as well. The first and most prominent theory is that Dawn and Kevin stumbled upon a drug trafficking operation. It was said that this area where they had been in was a place that some drug drops took place from an airplane. So maybe some sort of drug drop or exchange was taking place in the woods and the boys stumbled upon it and was killed to keep them quiet. In support of this theory, in 2018, a former WWE wrestler named Billy Haynes came forward with a shocking claim. Billy stated that he had been part of a drug trafficking ring operating in Arkansas, and that during the summer of 1987, he was providing security for a drug drop when he witnessed the murders of Kevin and Don. Billy didn't just claim he was present. He named six other individuals he said were also there that night. Among those names were three law enforcement officers, two attorneys who were also politicians, and a bouncer from a local nightclub. He further alleged that corruption within the state of Arkansas ran deep, extending to high-ranking officials. Now, I want to be clear. These are allegations. But when you look at the pattern surrounding this case, the number of suspicious deaths, multiple witnesses reporting police involvement, and then someone coming forward decades later claiming firsthand knowledge, it does make you stop and think. Personally, I find this theory disturbingly plausible. At some point, the coincidences begin to feel overwhelming. And you have to ask yourself, why would Billy Haynes, this former WWE wrestler, randomly insert himself into a case like this? Coming forward and claiming involvement in a drug ring and admitting to witnessing a double homicide are not small or casual statements. Those are serious and bold accusations. I mean, could someone lie for attention? Absolutely. Stranger things have happened, and they do happen all the time. But his claims do align with the idea that Don and Kevin may have been killed because they saw something they weren't supposed to see. Another theory involves the unidentified man seen in military fatigues, the same individual who had previously fired at police officers. His violent behavior alone makes him difficult to rule out completely, but there simply isn't enough information available to definitively exclude him as a suspect. When I step back and look at the full picture, I truly believe this case was mishandled from the very beginning. There were witnesses who reported police involvement. There were individuals who believed they were being followed by police, only to later be murdered. There was a deeply flawed initial investigation that dismissed the boys' death as an accident almost immediately. And then there were allegations involving prosecutors and other powerful figures in the state. Taking all of that together, it feels like an extraordinary amount of effort may have gone into making sure that the truth never fully comes out. Kevin's mother, Linda Ives, spent decades fighting for justice for the boys. Tragically, Linda passed away in June of 2021 without ever receiving answers about what truly happened to Kevin and his best friend. Most members of the Henry and Ives families believe they may never know the truth, and that is an incredibly heavy reality to live with. Before her death, Linda worked closely with investigative journalist Mara Leverett to help write the book Boys on the Tracks: Death, Denial, and a Mother's Crusade to Bring Her Son's Killer to Justice. The book went on to win awards and is still available today. I will make sure to link it in the episode description for anyone who wants to learn more and read further into this case. Lastly, I want to mention something meaningful. In April of 2012, according to KATV, a group of community members pushed to have a memorial bench placed in Alexander Park in honor of Kevin and Don. A dedication ceremony was held, and Linda Ives later said how much it meant to her that people still remembered what happened to her son and to Don. Unfortunately, that is pretty much all the information that I have for you guys. If you have information or believe you know someone who does, there is an anonymous tip line that you can contact at 888-580-8477. This tip line allows you to report information safely and anonymously. I know fear often keeps people from coming forward, but sometimes even the smallest detail can make a big difference. Crimesters, if you're not already a part of my private Facebook group, you can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all pictures and information pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. If you want to keep up with all that I have going on in life, you can find me on Instagram at Crimeaholly. And if you would like more true crime content, you can follow me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. Lastly, check the episode description for not only the link to my Patreon, but there is also a case suggestion form. I would love to see which cases you guys would like to hear me cover. That is all for this week's episode. Until next time, you guys know what to do. Be aware and take care. Bye-bye.